The Brad Sessmatt Show, broadcasting live.
Off we go into another week. Thanks for being with us. Tyzik is our chairman of the board. If anything goes wrong, it's his fault. Had a great sports weekend. We had staff in Indianapolis. We had staff at the Final Four. I was down at the Final Four on the women's side for a bit. Eliab was in Indianapolis. Jordy, Spurge, Claudia, Jeff Metcalf, they all crushed it. So, and there's a lot going on. There's a big trade in the WNBA involving Angel Reese here in a second. So, opening comments are brought to you by Desert Financial Credit Union. Desert Financial Credit Union, taking care of you, taking care of your business. As always and through the years, that is Desert Financial Credit Union. We do appreciate their support. John Wilner will join us at 10:15 this morning. It is national championship game. We had John on Saturday night after U of A got bludgeoned. And I want to know who he's putting his money on tonight. That's really what I want. We want to know where the money is going from John Wilner. Also, there was a dust-up over the weekend with a big cigar at Texas Tech and the commissioner of the Big 12. And this whole Tommy Lloyd contract thing where he doesn't have to report directly to the athletic director, how much, you know, stock does John Wilner put in all that now that Tommy Lloyd has been given a contract extension to stay and not go to North Carolina? That and much more coming up on today's show. Let's get started with the Final Four because it is tonight. The championship game is tonight. And I like Connecticut tonight. I like Connecticut, even though I picked Michigan in my bracket, just watching the two teams. And look, here's my thing. I am one of those people, if I pick somebody 3 weeks ago and then say, you know, I have to stick with them. No, there is nothing written in stone that I have to do anything. I can flip if I want. Even though if Michigan were to win tonight, I have a very, very slim chance of winning the Sessmatt family pool. And there's some big bucks involved there, let me tell you. But I'm looking at this objectively and saying I believe that in the coaching matchup that Connecticut has an advantage. Michigan is not playing at 100%. UConn's a little beat up too. I don't believe that this will be a game that will be in the over. I had the over the other night with U of A and Michigan, and I won that handily, I must tell you. So that's where it is. I like Connecticut. In terms of what happened to Arizona, was it a good season? Was it a great season? Anything short of a championship is a wasted season. That's where we are now in this day and age of college athletics. To me, it was a beyond terrific season for anybody who follows the University of Arizona Wildcats. And those of you that are new to the program, I don't care. I just don't care who wins. I don't sit here and, oh, I'm rooting. No, I'm not. Never root. Don't care. All I want is competitive and fun and entertain me with a good style of basketball. Not a bunch of garbage three-pointers from downtown and dunks. Don't care. I want to see the game being played the right way. I'm watching U of A the other night, and it was a lead balloon. There's no question about it. And then I think of things like if Koa Pete had committed to Arizona State at the last minute instead of committing to U of A, even though there are people that said he's going to U of A all along because there's just too many tentacles already into him on the agent side with family members and so on. But I'm watching him and thinking it came this close. Koa stays and goes to Arizona State. Bobby doesn't get fired. There's an energy and enthusiasm. They win a couple more games. But instead, he goes to Tucson. He gets all the way to the Final Four. And that body is only going to grow, man. He is so impressive. So impressive to watch. On the women's side, I went down to the Final Four on Saturday. I did not go yesterday. I went down Friday. And Jay Perry and their team, once again, did everything as well as they could, as well as they should. And now it's really on our elected officials and people behind the scenes, sports owners in town that need to get out of the sandbox and all work together and pull on the rope together to get more big events here. We had a space where there was one mega event after another, after another, after another. And you could see, this is like in the late 20 teens. You could see where Las Vegas was like, we're going to step in here. And I went on a rampage. And one night in particular, a couple of the news stations came out to the house and put me on and said, so why do you feel this way? And we're not circling the wagons. Well, they weren't happy with me about it. And here we are now, 7 years later, and the wagons, Jay's trying to circle the wagons. But if you think it's just, oh, we'll put in a nice little bid and we'll have everything downtown, it wasn't perfect. There were some things that I saw. They're like, there were some events, you know, over GCU, they had an event on Saturday afternoon that was lightly attended. It doesn't all fall on the host committee. It falls on the marketing people. It just falls on, maybe it's too far away from where the hotels were. But when we have these mega events like spring training and a women's Final Four, and if you're one of those who don't believe that it benefits you in any way, shape, or form, I can't convince you otherwise. You are just going to be one of those people that is always stuck in the cycle of sports is no good. And I'd say go watch the arts. Go do something else then. Because that was a positive for our community. I saw restaurants that were packed in downtown Phoenix. And they're not packed unless there's an event going on down there. You could fire off a cannon some nights on Jefferson Street, not hit anybody. But you have a Diamondback game, the same time the Final Four is going on, same time some business conventions are going on, and downtown was buzzing, and it was great to see. I am very big on that. You know, the Geno dust up after he ends up losing took away a little bit. Not a lot, because UCLA wins easily, wins hands down. The baseball team, can we please find a left-handed reliever? I'm getting tired of friends texting saying, why do we have no left-handers? Why do we have no left-handers in the bullpen? Once again, yesterday, the Diamondbacks bullpen crapped the bed, but they were pulled out by Ketel Marte, and they actually have a good homestand. They go 5-2 on the homestand, and now they're off today. They're in New York against the Mets tomorrow. Happy with where they are at this point of the season. You already hear people in Boston saying the year is over. In San Francisco, we made the wrong choice of a manager. And so on and so on and so on. I'm not happy that the general manager has given the manager, like, okay, tie one arm behind your back. And when you need a lefty with two outs in the night, like Randy Choate's not available. Give me anybody. Give me a left-hander. Anybody that could be available. Your sons, they went at Chicago. Devin Booker at 30, Jalen Green at 25. They host Kevin Durant in Houston tomorrow. The Suns have started to do this, but is it because it's the end of the regular season and Dylan Brooks is rested up and Mark, or is it just simply, yeah, now teams are starting to get ready for the postseason. This is what real basketball looks like. Like, the Suns are a nice team that's put together for the regular season. If you think that they have any shot at beating Oklahoma City or San Antonio in a seven-game series, that's what fandom's all about, I guess. You know, you have to have hope, but reality is that's not happening. And it's Masters Week, which means guys like me are going to get very little done as the week progresses. The further into this week, the less and less I'm going to be sitting here saying I have to do this. I have to do that. It's just, it's not who I am, because I find entertainment. Alan Shipnuck's going to be with us in a few minutes to preview the Masters. None better than Alan. He just wrote a new book on Rory McIlroy that's tremendous that we will get into. So if you're a fan of golf, like I am, Alan Shipnuck, one of the great authors, controversial authors, I must add, because he doesn't always say everything is great. Everything's not always pretty and rosy, and there's people that get mad at him, including Rory in this book. This book is really good. Alan Shipnuck comes up in about a half hour. Up next, it's John Wilner and Wilner Hotline. I'm Brad Sussmat. Here now is John Wilner. Wilner Hotline, as always, nationally syndicated columnist, everything across the fruited plain of college athletics, football, basketball primarily, but everything else. All right, tonight, what does your gut say? UConn, Michigan, John.
My head says Michigan will win handily, way they've won handily every round. My gut says UConn will keep it close, closer than the point spread, which I think is about 7.5.
That seems
Dan
hot.
Hurley has been lights out against the spread. He is 11-0 against the spread in the Sweet 16, Elite Eight, and Final Four. you know, UConn just plays a completely different style of offense than Arizona. And I think it is better suited to, you know, score and give Michigan a little bit of trouble defensively, right? Arizona played right into their hands. It's just the way Arizona plays is the way Michigan plays. Inside out, big men, physical, and Michigan is just bigger and more physical. UConn is all perimeter oriented with their offense. And I think that could cause Michigan a little trouble. Plus, you know, like I said, Hurley is a master. They've just got so much moxie. I think it's going to be close. Not down to the wire, maybe, but it will be a competitive game with 5 minutes left.
I have to tell you, in the last 24 hours, all I've heard about is Hurley.
Yep.
I haven't heard anything about over on the Michigan sideline. What do you make out of Coach May?
Terrific coach. He just announced, it was either yesterday or the day before, he's not interested in the North Carolina job. He's staying at Michigan. That'll force the Tar Heels to go probably to number three or four on their list. I think Billy Donovan is their new target. But, you know, May did a great job at Florida Atlantic. Michigan hired him. He has done what a lot of big-time programs have not done. Mm-hmm. He has spent wisely in the portal, right? They don't have any dead money. You look at Kentucky, you look at some other schools, they've got a lot of guys who don't fit with what they're trying to do. And so they're spending a couple million bucks on players who don't work in the system. Michigan has a bunch of transfers, but they spent on pieces that work together and work within May's system. And that's the key. There's a lot of schools that can spend 10, 15, 20 million on the roster, but you got to make it work.
Right, right. Well, I'll just bounce right over then to this Big 12 dust up. The commissioner of the Big 12 gets in a dust up with the big cigar at Texas Tech.
Yeah.
About throwing money around, and you don't tell us what to do. We tell you what to do. And,
right.
And so, you know, a place like Michigan where they've got it under control for basketball, that's not the case across the fruited plain nowadays. You do have these crazy guys like a Texas Tech, John.
You do. I mean, here's the equivalent. All right. So Cody Campbell, billionaire, he's funding Texas Tech's roster. He's chair of the Texas Tech Regents. And technically, Brett Yormark works for Texas Tech, is 1/16 of his, of his membership.
Yeah, yeah.
But the whole conference voted to have football games on Friday nights. And it's a good window for them on Fox. The equivalent would be, or would have been, if Phil Knight had in 2014 or 2016 or 2018 stepped forward publicly and said to Larry Scott in the Pac-12, I don't like Oregon playing on on Friday night. We got to change this. That wouldn't have happened. It never happened. It's a bad look for the conference. And to me, it is a sign, like it's a breadcrumb on a road that could lead to big trouble, you know, in 3-4 years.
Yeah. I wish Phil Knight would have stepped in on Larry Scott. I wish he would have stepped in on. I mean, I wish he would have stepped all over and on top of and stomped the Pac-12 leadership or lack thereof. But
yeah.
Well, the Arizona it's interesting. State, I mean, all those people were jokes, John. They were jokes.
They certainly had their fair share of mistakes and got paid a lot of money to make those mistakes. There's no doubt. The thing is that Yormark he's not under fire, but a few of his strategic decisions, like the basketball court at the Big 12 championship game, you know, this Friday night thing, the private equity deal, trying to add UConn and Gonzaga, the focus on basketball in a football world. Not everything he's doing is playing great on all the campuses. Now, that's okay. The commissioner, you know, he's supposed to bring them ideas, but the fact that a booster, and let's face it, I mean, it's not like Texas Tech is Texas, right? They had one good football season, and now they think they run the place. It's a little bit comical and a little bit sad and a little bit embarrassing for the Big 12.
Okay, John Wilner with us for a few minutes. Wilner Hotline, national championship game is tonight. I want to pivot over to the situation at the University of Arizona where Tommy Lloyd gets a contract extension, and the headline below the headline below the headline below the headline is he doesn't have to report to the AD.
Yes.
John, how common is this? For the fans that aren't aware, if you could fill them in on the Tommy Lloyd deal where the AD is no longer somebody has to even acknowledge.
Well, I am not sure that that report is entirely correct. I do believe that, and I think Desiree Reed-Francois was even asked about it subsequent. That was a report from CBS Sports. Sports Illustrated subsequently asked her about it. And she said on matters, I believe, of budget, finance, operations, that there is, she is going to be working with basketball. So I don't think it's a deal where every decision that needs to be made up the chain goes straight from Tommy Lloyd to the university president. Okay. Now, but clearly he used this to get some leverage.
Sure.
All right. And in term, and I think the focus of that leverage is the total money amount, total money allocated to basketball versus football with revenue sharing and NIL. Like if there's $2 million and it's, you know, quarterback versus point guard, you know, and I'm kind of generalizing here, well, it's going to go to the point guard. That's kind of my takeaway, is that he's going to get the benefit of the doubt on dollar decisions. Arizona doesn't have unlimited dollars for football and men's basketball. And this clearly suggests that basketball's the priority, that it makes sense given Arizona's history. I'm not sure it makes complete sense given the future of college athletics, but that appears to be kind of the state of play at this point.
So is this a case study or is this just me overreacting to what I read?
I think it could be a case study. We'll see. Because, I'm thinking about it. It's something I've been thinking about for a couple of days.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a case study.
Yeah, because Brent Brennan's over there saying, well, we lost out on a guy by $1 million because the basketball team took it.
Yeah.
Or the basketball coach is saying, that football kid can't play dead. I want this over here on my side of the street. And the dollar's only going to go up every year. Every year, the cap's going to go up and up.
The cap is going up. The NIL, and both the revenue sharing cap and the NIL are going to go up every year. There's no doubt. And I don't know exactly how much Arizona has for the totality of its football and basketball rosters, right? You know, is it $40 million? Is it $30 million? I'm not sure. And I don't know if there are places they can go to get more. You know, they have some pretty affluent alumni, and that's the unknown piece to this. And the reason I'm hesitant to call it a full-on test case or a full-on mistake, because there may be dollars available that we're not privy to.
Well, but here's the thing. I'd be naive, and you covered U of A for many years. For people who don't know, John was in Tucson and covered that whole deal. So when
just like this.
Yeah, you and Lou, just like, So when you have a Jim Click or others that step in and say, why are we dinking around with Tommy Lloyd in North Carolina? This is what you're going to do. Or Steve Kerr picks up the phone and say, this is what you're going to do. Is there some of that involved with specifically the University of Arizona when it comes to basketball?
You know, I'm sure that there are some big donors that have the president's ear. There's no doubt they have to. I mean, he's got to understand that. He's not super into sports, is my understanding. But he recognizes the primacy of Arizona basketball, what it means to the school as a branding agent, what it means to the community. So I'm sure that there's some of that, you know, and it's football's hard. I mean, we've seen for decades at both Arizona and ASU, it is, you know, it is hard to win at a high level consistently.
Right.
You see ASU cycle up, you see Arizona cycle up, and then they cycle down. It would take a lot of money on a year-to-year basis to get the Arizona football program to the point where it is relevant nationally, relevant in the Big 12. But at the same time, if you look at the future of college athletics, football, it's about football. I mean, look at Indiana. Indiana made a decision, we got to be good in football. They got three NCAA basketball championships. So we'll see a few too many unknowns to draw any definitive conclusions, but it will be interesting to watch the trajectory of Arizona basketball and football over the next 3 or 4 years, given how Lloyd has positioned his program within the university's political structure, so to speak.
All right. Good answer there. I like that. Real deep dive. Before I get you out of here, so I had you on the other night. and you're kind of dancing around on where your gut was on the game. You gave me a little bit off the top. Where's your money tonight, John?
My money? My
Where's
nickel?
Your money tonight? Where is your $10 allowance for tonight? Where's
my
it going?
Nickel? My nickel is on UConn plus, is it 7.5? I haven't looked in the last couple of days. I think it opened at 7. It moved to 7.5. I'm going to take UConn. I got like 77 or 73, 66, 75, 69, something like that. I don't think Michigan's going to get to 90. They have against everybody else. I don't think they're going to get to 90 against UConn. But I think they will. I don't think that it's going to be in doubt with a minute left. But it will be a much better game than we saw Arizona against Michigan, and a much better game Michigan's had against anybody else.
Let you go off that. Appreciate your time as always. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Brett.
And we're back with more after this timeout. All right. As always, whenever I do a book interview, the thing is we want you to buy the book. Okay. So if I sit here with Alan Shipnick, one of the greats in golf writing, and say, what about this story? What about this story? What about this story? That really doesn't help him. And you're not going to go buy the book, but I will tell you that I got the book last week. I'm old school. I like to read before I talk with someone. And unfortunately for Alan, as he joins us for a few minutes, we're going to talk about Rory. I have to talk about Gary Woodland, which is a great story.
Yeah,
got to talk about what just happened with Tiger last night. And we'll get to Rory and see if I can tie it all together. So I hope you'll let me go down that path with you, Alan, because there's just too much going on in golf today.
Oh, yeah. I'm at your disposal, Brad. It's all good. Don't worry about it.
All right. So Gary Woodland, let's start there. I'll go in the news cycle to where we are today. Gary Woodland breaks down on Golf Channel a couple of weeks back. You ever seen a story quite like that on the mental health side, Alan?
Yeah, it was powerful. And, you know, Gary Woodland's always been one of the good guys. Like every reporter, he's a go-to interview because he's agreeable. He's smart. I have a friend who caddied for the amateur in Woodland's group for a few years at Pebble Beach, and said he was just a total gent who was nice to every volunteer, every fan, every caddy. Like, so that's partly why the story resonated, because he spread so much goodwill into the golf world for so long. And it was powerful. I mean, if you watch the Full Swing show on Netflix, you know, when Woodland talked about, you know, he's having brain surgery and he had to write these letters to his family in case he died on the operating table. And people have been cheering for him all along, but no one understood the depths of his struggle, you know, this PTSD that he's felt and the inner turmoil. And for him to be so open and honest, you know, that's always admirable. You hope that it helps other people who are also struggling. And then to go out and win for the first time in 7 years, it was just a remarkable turn of events. And so it's such a feel-good story. You can't say enough good things about Gary as a golfer and a human. And we really needed it coming on the heels of sort of the darkness of the Tiger Woods, you know, accident and fallout. And so it was quite a juxtaposition emotionally for golf fans and people in the game.
Name of the book is Rory. We're going to get to it in a minute. Alan authored it. It's out. It is available with Masters coming up next week. Make sure that you get a copy.
You're scaring me. Like, all of a sudden, Rory's on the screen. You're terrifying me, Brad. Jeez.
There we go. This is how I do book interviews. I love doing it like this, especially with someone of your caliber. Where were you when you heard the news of the Tiger accident? And where were you when you heard the news that he was going to go check himself in?
Yeah, it's, I had a book event here in Monterey. It's kind of like this lunch club, all jacket required, very old school. It's like all these old Italian guys who run Monterey. And, and we were kind of sitting there. I would speak, and then we used to have this big feast for lunch, and the news started to break, and it was like, it's just deja vu. We've been down this road so many times with Tiger, these news breaks. Oh, he was in an accident. Is he dead? Is he alive? Oh no, he's okay. Oh, now he's arrested. Like, it's just, it's melancholy. I think that's my overriding emotion, that this guy who has brought us so much joy as a performer, who enriched our lives as sports fans, who showed us like the potential for human greatness. And it was so uplifting to watch him. It was so mesmerizing. And now we're going on a decade and a half of just scandal and decline and this tainting of his legacy. It's just really sad. And I do have empathy for Tiger. I think we probably all have people in our lives who struggle with addiction, and it's clearly a battle he's losing. And that's, it's just tough to watch. I mean, at the same time, the behavior is so reckless, endangering himself and anybody else on the road. You have to, there's a sense of outrage too. Like, and it's also with the people around him. Like, you know, if you know people who are struggling as a friend, you have to come through for them. And clearly he's been let down by the people around him who mostly are on his payroll, and they benefit from Tiger just being Tiger. But it's just a very sad story, and it's hard to watch.
Were you, what were your thoughts when it was announced that he was going in to get treatment?
It's obviously a necessary step. I think it's admirable for Tiger to do it publicly. Again, there's many people out there who are struggling with the same addictions, and maybe he'll inspire some other people to get help as well. So that could be the good in this story, but it's clearly, Tiger's at yet another crossroads. And what matters is, you know, as him as a human being there for his kids, and that's the important story. There is the golf side of it, which, you know, he's been presumed to be the next Ryder Cup captain. There was this kind of deadline around the Masters for him to commit. This throws all that in turmoil. You know, Team Europe is this machine. Luke Donald's been installed as captain for months. Yet again, the U.S. side is just flailing around for leadership. So that's a bummer. If you're a fan of the U.S. team, it's like Tiger has messed up this whole process. He's been running the PGA Tour in a de facto way, you know, and now he's going to – all that is in question. And are they going to have to fill his spot on the board? And who's it going to be? And how's that going to affect everything? Like, it's just – He's lucky that he's alive. He's lucky he didn't kill anybody. Those are the important things. But on the golf side, he's just created more mess other people are going to have to clean up.
Would you have a book in you on him at this point in his career and what he's been through? I mean, I'm sure you do or would.
But I've been approached by various publishers to write a Tiger biography, and I'm really not interested because, first of all, it's been done to death. There's probably been 25 books about Tiger. And the early ones, when people had access to him, you know, like John Strege's, which was the first one, Tom Callahan, like those were great. But the 20 that have followed, you know, he's at such a remove, and his inner self is this well-guarded fortress. And even Tiger was going to write his own book. And, you know, the co-writer was going to be this guy, J.R. Moeringer, who he wrote Andre Agassi's autobiography, which is the gold standard. He wrote Prince Harry's book, which is one of the best-selling books of the last few decades. Like, he's a genius at getting people to open up and to tell their story in a compelling way. And he walked away from the project because Tiger wouldn't say anything. He wouldn't be honest or real. And so I'm not really drawn to Tiger as a subject. That I did write a novel in 2013 with my great friend Michael Bamberger. It is about a cross-cultural golfing icon whose life goes off the rail in a tabloid-fueled sex scandal. Some people think it's inspired by Tiger Woods. Simon & Schuster lawyers would insist that it's fiction and it's all made up. But there are some parallels. And in a way, that was a chance to write about a figure like Tiger and do it in a more artistic way. And so that could be considered my Tiger opus, depending on how you look at it. But it's also now at this point, it's just a depressing story. I mean, it was like, you know, if you saw that Elvis movie, the first half was so fun. It's the rise of Elvis and the music and the excitement. And the second half is just this sad decline. And you walk out of the theater a little depressed. And I feel like that's what a Tiger book would be. Whereas like, the Rory book is a feel-good story. Like, it has this crescendo at the end, and he's an admirable person who's carried himself, you know, with a lot of grace and dignity in the public spotlight. And I wanted to write a feel good book. And I just don't think that you could do that with Tiger.
What's interesting about what you just said there is in reading this, and it's out, by the way, if I haven't said that enough, it's out. We don't really look alike. Alan Shipnick with us, the author, one of the greats in the sport of golf and covering it, is Rory's very controlled. And in reading through your book, I'm again not going to give it all away, but right in the foreword, you guys are in a private jet and there's a conversation there. And Tiger's name is actually very early on in the book too, about Rory asking what's he like and so on. How well do you two get along, and how easy was this book or difficult this book to put together with him?
Yeah. I mean, I've had a lot of great access to Rory in his career. When he announced his Nike deal, I was over in Abu Dhabi for that. And I spent a lot of time with him, and I've been in his victories. I've been in his defeats. I've had a lot of stolen moments with him in the locker room or in parking lots. And he's the most emotionally accessible superstar of the modern age in golf. Like, he lets you into his heart, and he's brutally honest about any number of things. And so he's very different. You know, Tiger never said anything. His press conferences were these word salads where he revealed nothing about himself. Rory is just a very different character. But and so when I approached Rory and told him I was doing this book, you know, I was hopeful he would sit down and have these long conversations with me, because he's a great talker and he's done this many times in his life with podcasts and magazine stories. And I've been on the other end of a couple of those interviews through the years. But when you get to be a superstar like Rory is, what you really want is control. And even though he can be so open, he does have total control of his image as it goes out. You know, he has a team of people who do his social media for him. He doesn't do any of that stuff. His blue chip sponsors, those ad campaigns, are obviously, he has creative say in those. The content that the PGA Tour and the European Tour put out, he gets to vet. And he knew when I was never going to give him that kind of control. Like, he was not going to get to read the manuscript before it went to print. And for someone like Rory, he's used to always having, he's used to calling the shots and everything, that's unsettling. So he declined to do any interviews. And we, you know, you're alluding to the forward of the book. We had a pretty spicy exchange.
You sparred a little bit.
Yeah, at Oakmont Country Club during the U.S. Open. And that's fine. That, you know, I've been doing this job a long time. He's not the first golfer who's been mad at me. It's part of the job if you do it a certain way. And it's fine. There is a happy ending, though. So I wrote the book. And honestly, you know, I don't write the book for Rory. I write it for golf fans. That's the constituency I care about. And just like with the Mickelson biography, like, my only goal, I'm not trying to tell people how to feel or legislate to them about this is a good person or a bad person. I just want to capture who they really are, and in an honest, unflinching way. And so, you know, Rory's had, he's had his controversies and the mess and messiness in his love life and his business life, with LIV Golf, sundry other things. It's all in the book because that's the totality of the man. But, there's also a lot of stuff that speaks to his, you know, his good character and his good cheer. And so, and people will take it from it what they will, just like they did with the Mickelson book. But I think it's an uplifting story. And yeah. And so when, you know, Rory's defending champ at Pebble Beach, I live in Northern, you know, nearby. So when the week of the Pebble tournament, you know, 6 weeks ago, whatever, I met his manager, Sean O'Flaherty, and I gave him a couple copies of the book. And I told him I wouldn't give you the book early if I thought you were going to hate it. Like, I think if you read it with an open mind, you guys will love it. And so that afternoon, you know, Rory came into the press conference. He walked right up to me. Excuse me. He shook my hand and said, "Hey, thanks for the book. I'm looking forward to reading it." And I said, "I hope you do. You know, I think you'll like it." And he said, "You know, I'll tell you if I do." But that was in front of the whole press corps, in front of PGA Tour officials, tournament officials. Like, I think that was kind of Rory's public, you know, gesture to kind of bury the hatchet after he had thrown a few F-bombs at me at the Oakmont driving range. And so I appreciated that. And then if you fast forward, you know, six more days, it's Sunday night, I'm writing my my tournament story. I finish it in the press room. I'm walking to my car. It's dark. It's misty at Pebble Beach. the whole place is cleared out. But I see these two figures walking toward me, and I know instantly that one of them is Rory, just by the way he moves. And it was Rory and his caddy. They were going to the tap room, you know, to have a little eat and drink. And so I made a joke, like, of all the people you're going to run into on a dark, you know, cold night in Pebble Beach. And he laughed, and he said, I read the first chapter of the book, and he said, it made me laugh. I liked it. And I said, okay, well, just keep going. And so I'm in a good place with Rory as far as the book goes. And on a human level, I'm happy about that. But I was always just going to write the book I wanted to write. And whether he loved it or hated it, that was not going to change, you know, one word. So, but it's gratifying. You know, he's a discerning reader. So I'm pleased that he was entertained.
I was entertained. Again, not to give away the book. There's just a few lines in there about a young Rory, a very, very young Rory. Alan goes all the way back to the roots and the golf club where they wash their clubs. The sign over the toilet says, do not wash your clubs in the toilet.
It's amazing. Like, yeah, have you ever seen anybody do that in a clubhouse? Like, it's just hilarious that sign even exists.
Yeah, yeah. This year for Rory, with the Masters coming up, a year ago at this time after he won, there was this, is it going to be a Rory slam? What are your expectations? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, obviously his preparation's been compromised. You know, he tweaked his back in the gym, and he's going to go into Augusta having not played in 3 weeks. But I think Rory knows how to answer the bell, and he'll be sharp. I think he's either going to shoot 62 or he's going to shoot 79 on the first round. It might be the easiest round of golf he ever plays, and he'll be completely free and joyful. And he'll just attack Augusta, and he'll make birdies like crazy. Or I think there is a risk that either he'll try too hard or he'll be a little overwhelmed by the emotion, and it might go sideways on him. I don't see Rory shooting even par and having a boring round of golf. That's not how he is. But I would not be surprised if he were to defend. I mean, he's cracked the code on that golf course. He's just become a fundamentally better golfer with his emphasis on his putting and his wedge play. And Rory hungers to add to his legacy. He was very aware of his place in golf history. I get into all this in the last chapter. I'd say he's already ascended to be one of the dozen greatest players of all time. But, you know, he's won one Masters. So is Danny Willett. So is Charles Schwartzel. Mm-hmm. So is Larry Mize. There's a lot of guys with one Masters. Rory wants to be in a different category. He wants to be a multiple Masters champion. He wants to win an Open at St. Andrews. He wants to win a U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. Like, he hungers after these crown jewels of the sport. And it seems like he's been around forever. He's still only 36. And, you know, he's okay. He tweaked his back. He hurt his ribs in 2017. And he hurt his ankle playing soccer once. But he's been relatively injury-free for such a long career. And Jordan Spieth is having surgery, and Brooks Koepka is having surgery, and people are breaking down. And Rory's been healthy, and his longevity is incredible. And I expect that a lot of his best golf is still in front of him, and it's going to be fun to watch.
Last question on this, and again, the name of the book is Rory. It is out with Alan Shipnick. With the news of Tiger, Rory's going to get peppered with questions about Tiger. And at what point does he just say, I'm here to talk about golf? And does he feel, I guess, Alan, I'm trying to phrase it the right way. What do you think he is feeling with the Tiger Woods story and the place in golf with him going through this? Is there anything on Rory? It's just, I'm going to go out and handle my own business.
No, it's the contrary. I think he has a lot of empathy and a lot of love for Tiger. You know, Tiger was his role model and his hero growing up. And then they've become peers and they become equals. I mean, there's four guys on planet Earth who have won the career Grand Slam. Tiger and Rory are two of them. And so Tiger has a respect for Rory. And, you know, they're business partners on the Tomorrow Golf League, the TGL. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that Rory might be the only person on the planet who can look Tiger in the eye and, you know, speak truth to power and tell him what he needs to hear. Because Tiger's surrounded by these enablers and these yes men and these guys on his payroll. And even though they've known him a long time, they can't really be tough on him. Tiger, and then Rory doesn't need anything from Tiger. Mm. He doesn't need anything from him. I think he could be there for him in friendship. And after Tiger's last accident, their friendship deepened. You know, Rory went to his house for the first time. He visited him. They spent time together. And I think, you know, if you gave Tiger true serum and if you asked if he could trade lives with Rory, I think he'd do it in a heartbeat. Even though Tiger has a lot more trophies, you know, Rory's healthy. He's happy. He's universally beloved. And he's going to be able to play with his daughter into old age. I mean, will Tiger ever be able to play golf with Charlie again? You know, the way his body's broken down, it's hard to say. And so I think Tiger has respect for Rory as a player and as a man. And I think that he would listen to him. And I'm not sure Rory wants that burden, but he's a big-hearted guy and he cares about Tiger. And I think he might be the one who could actually get through to him.
No, it's really good stuff. Really good stuff. And a sad, tough story. Rory, the book is out. Alan, I appreciate all the time and the efforts you put into this. We look forward to seeing your work down at Augusta. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brad.
And we're back with more after this time out.